I'm going to talk to you about a project that I've been working on in my laboratory for the last couple of years. It actually started with a high school student at a local high school in Hilo near our College of Pharmacy, whose father is a kava farmer. He owns a farm called Pinner Creek, and they also grow like turmeric and ginger, I believe. And he came to my laboratory interested in doing a high school senior project where he wanted to look at kava, and his main interest was in the hepatotoxicity or potential hepatotoxicity of some of the compounds that are present in the plant. And that's due to something I'll discuss a little bit later. There are spurious reports or sporadic reports of hepatotoxicity. It's very rare, actually. But the project actually grew out of that, and so I'm going to tell you a little story that developed from there. First off, I've got no conflicts of interest to disclose. I didn't know if that slide was necessary. I probably wish I did have conflicts. So first, I'll give you a description of kava, or ava, as it's known here in Hawaii. Apologies, I'm not a horticulturalist, so that's going to be a very brief description today. I'll discuss some of the chemical constituents, the documented biological effects of kava, studies on the flavocovains, that's the compound that we became mostly interested in, and looking at human hepatocytes. Our studies have been conducted in cultured cells in the HepG2 cell line, comparing the toxicity of different flavocovains, looking at the cellular responses they evoke, analyzing changes in gene expression that result, and from that, I'll outline some of the future directions. So let me jump right in. This is the plant. And the kava plant, what is consumed actually is an extract of roots, or the roots can just be chewed if they're fresh. I wouldn't try chewing the dried roots. But fresh, dried, or powdered, you consume it in the form of a beverage. Although you may have seen the local markets, you can actually buy it in a variety of forms. You can buy tinctures. You can buy even chocolate bars with kava. Not really sure how the effects compare. The main effect of consuming the beverage reportedly is anxiolytic. I've tried it myself. It's a little bit of an acquired taste, but it's actually a beverage that has some important cultural and significance to it. Again, a little bit outside of my area of expertise. As a pharmacologist, I'm more interested in pursuing the effects that it has on the body. So it also has other effects, not as well understood, on the immune system, metabolic effects, and also on the liver. And so our interest came from looking at a variety of metabolites that are present in kava. The most abundant of these are the kavalactones. There we go. The kavalactones, followed up by the chalcones and alkaloids. So when the beverage is consumed, it is a milky emulsion. So it contains both water-soluble and fat-soluble compounds in it. And the chalcones, being more fat-soluble, are also high in the ethanolic extracts that you sometimes can find here in the local markets that are meant as kind of like a speedy way of consuming the beverage as opposed to going through the laborious method of making the emulsion. So of these, flavocovain A, approximately a half a percent in abundance and in comparison to the dry weight of the roots, followed by flavocovains B and C. So we've mainly looked at A and B. If you're familiar with the chemical background of this, there is some potential chemistry here as mycorrhizoceptors, and so that might have something to do with the effects that we've observed. Flavocovains have been studied previously in a number of studies looking largely at their potential anti-cancer properties. Again, these are by far outshadowed by the kavalactones in terms of abundance, but they're quite potent and have some activities against a number of cancer cell lines like those shown here. Flavocovain A, for example, has been studied in bladder and breast cancers. B has been studied in prostate, colorectal, and squamous carcinomas with IC50s in the range of 10 to 20 micromolar. However, one of the things that you often hear about flavic veins and kava is that warning people not to consume it because of the potential for hepatotoxicity. And there have been in the past couple decades in the range of 50 to 100, according to the FDA, reports of across the globe of acute, pretty severe hepatotoxicity following the consumption of various forms of kava. They're not all the kind of traditional emulsion that I'd shown you previously. There was some speculation that some of this came from contamination of aerial parts of the plant that are higher in the toxic constituents. Some of the hepatotoxicity might also come from the co-use of kava along with compounds like acetaminophen, which also are, as you know, potentially hepatotoxic, and so they might have a potentiating effect in regards to toxicity. For our studies, we looked at the human hepatocyte cell line HepG2, studying these in culture, again, as Dr. Chang pointed out, with the lack of an animal facility. We have, and we're located over on the other side of this island, we have a research facility, but no animal facility as of yet, so we looked in the HepG2 cell line, looking at purified compounds, and comparing their toxicity as a starter to just see where we stood in regards to their effects on the hepatocytes. In regards to the IC50s, and this is a 72-hour toxicity test, just looking at viability, you can see that flavic vein B is much more toxic than flavic vein A. That's essentially something that's already known. Flavic vein A, on the other hand, it does slow cell growth, but it does not produce the overt cytotoxic cell killing that B does. And a lot of that, well, obviously, because of the small structural differences here, has something to do with the difference between the hydrogen atom or the methoxy group between A and B. So what my laboratory studies is gene expression and its relation to disease. And so, as an obvious starter for the student's high school project, we wanted to look at some of the changes in gene expression that occur when hepatocytes are exposed to flavic veins. So as you're probably familiar with already, but I'll run through anyways, transcription factors are major controllers of gene expression, which go through the processes of mRNA and protein expression to define what the cell is made up of and what it does, the so-called cellular makeup. And so what we do is we study those, how those changes in cellular makeup relate to what goes on here, and we're asking the question of what happened at the mRNA and protein levels when flavic veins were added. We focused on A and B largely because A is the most abundant, B is the second most abundant, and also the most reported in the literature in regards to its hepatotoxicity. Looking at the genes that change the most, we find that heat shock genes changed, focusing here on an HSP70 isoform and an HSP40 isoform, you can see that in the range of 20 to 100 micromolar flavic vein A and 5 to 20 micromolar flavic vein B, we get a nice dose-dependent induction of both of these heat shock genes, and the proteins also go up. The reason we didn't go higher in flavic vein B is because of the acute toxicity of that compound. We also looked at antioxidant genes. I'm sorry, these are also at 24 hours. So we also looked at antioxidant genes, looking at here hemoxygenase and GCLC involved in glutathione biosynthesis, and their mRNA and protein levels also go up in a dose-dependent manner. So the question here is, when you observe these changes in gene expression, they can inform you essentially of what the compounds are doing to the cell and the way that the cell is responding to the presence of the compounds is to bolster the cellular defenses. We're exposed all the time to oxidants and reactive compounds, whether they're endogenous like malondialdehyde or hydroxynonenal, or xenobiotics from the outside world, then those have the potential of causing cellular damage and leading to degenerative diseases or potentially cancer, like Dr. Chang pointed out was one of the hallmarks of inflammation and exposure to these damaging compounds. So we observed a number of changes that are all related to cytoprotection in these cells after the exposure to flavic veins. I'm ultimately tracing these back to the two transcription factors, NRF2 and HSF1, which control the antioxidant and heat shock responses respectively. And so, as you can see here, one of the ways in which these are controlled is through nuclear translocation. In non-treated or unstimulated cells, these transcription factors don't really need to do much, and so they're outside outside of the nucleus and the cytoplasm, sequestered by these inhibitory proteins. And when a stressor is experienced, then it causes the translocation. There's other things that go on, like phosphorylation or acetylation, that also tie into this, but you ultimately get changes in gene expression. We wanted to look more closely at what was happening in regards to the turning on of these pathways. And so we developed an HSF1 and NRF2 reporter constructs expressed in a luciferase reporter vector that when HSF1 or NRF2 are active, then it essentially turns on the luciferase gene that generates light. This is something that was cloned out of fireflies, or lightning bugs, as I like to call them. So we transfected HepG2 cells, treated them with flavicovanes, and then simply assayed by adding a substrate in the appropriate lysis reagents, and we could count essentially how much activity we're getting in regards to gene expression. We got some pretty nice looking dose response curves for both NRF2 and HSF1, with on the left hand side we have flavicovane A. Where are you? There you are. Flavicovane A turning on NRF2 with an EC50 of 14 micromolar. Flavicovane B turning on it as well with an IC50 is just a little bit less, probably within error. HSF1, Dervin luciferase expression also goes up, so turning on with heat shock response with both A and B. And as I mentioned, one of the regulatory mechanisms for this is translocation from the cytoplasm into the nucleus. And so after adding either flavicovanes A on the left or flavicovane B on the right, we see an increase in the nuclear expression of both of these transcription factors that results in, among other things, an increase in glutathione biosynthesis, which is related to protective pathways like glutathione peroxidase helps get rid of oxidants, or direct reactions with electrophiles or xenobiotics helps to alleviate the stress that those cause on the cell. Similar to what sulforaphane does, and I'm sure you're familiar with the presence of sulforaphane in cruciferous vegetables like broccoli or Brussels sprouts, and the turning on of NRF2 is one of the things that sulforaphane is capable of doing. It's been shown to have protective actions against cancer, neurodegenerative diseases, and also promote immunity. So we wanted to compare basically the effects of FKA, FKB at subtoxic concentrations. Remember, if you get up high enough with flavicovane B, it is overtly cytotoxic. And also sulforaphane on both, which turn on HSF1 and NRF2. So we pre-treated for 24 hours, came back, and exposed these hepatocytes that have been theoretically protected now that they've turned on these response pathways to an oxidative stress, hydrogen peroxide, and looked for cell death. And what we observed was a protective effect of pre-treatment with flavicovanes A and B, similar to what you observe with sulforaphane, which is, again, has an antioxidant effect. This was a 24-hour pre-treatment followed by a 72-hour post-treatment with hydrogen peroxide. So all of that's been published, and what I'm going to talk about now is non-published data that grew out of this as an interest of ours to look further into the effects of flavicovanes on gene expression. We did an experiment in which we treated cells with flavicovane A and at a subtoxic concentration, and asked the question, what genes go up, what genes go down, looking at the Affymetrix clarium chip, which is 20,800 genes present. So of the top 50 upregulated genes, what I've highlighted here in red are the known NRF2 and HSF1 target genes. These are the responses, the antioxidant and electrophile stress or heat shock responses That was not surprising, but was great to see because it confirmed our results. In fact, the very top one up there going somewhere in the range of about 500-fold increase, which kind of blows me away, but is heme oxygenase 1. There are some other interesting things in here, but we also looked at the downregulated genes, and what we find in there, and I've shown you in green, is that there's a pretty significant downregulation of a number of genes involved in cholesterol biosynthesis and distribution, which kind of brings us into a potential new territory in regards to the bioactivity of these compounds. And I thought this was really interesting because if you look at the biosynthesis pathway for cholesterol, and this was stolen from a JBC mini-review article, then you'll see that many of the genes that we observed to go down or decrease upon flavulgovane A treatment for 6 hours are involved in, of course, cholesterol biosynthesis. And just for reference sake, there's the targeted statins. That's HMG-CoA reductase. So we're both up and downstream of HMG-CoA reductase. Two of these in particular are IDI1 and HMG-CS1, which I go back here. There's IDI1 cursor and HMG-CS1, so flanking HMG-CoA reductase. We see decreases in a dose-dependent manner with flavulgovane A treatment after 6 hours in both of these gene products and also at the protein level. So that is kind of an obvious area that we're going to continue looking at, and the next step for us is going to be to study effects on cholesterol biosynthesis, whether or not it's actually having a biological effect. We also want to determine the mechanism for this effect. Why are genes getting turned off? NRF2 and HSF1, although they can have repressive functions, are typically thought of as kind of turning on genes. One of the things that we're interested in looking at here, and all of these genes that I've shown you that go down, are what they have in common is that they're targets of SREBP2, which is a master regulator of cholesterol biosynthesis in the body. So, there's a few words of caution, though. It sounds great and it looks really interesting at first glance, but we have to be careful. We have run our bioassays on a short term. So we've done HepG2 cell culture over up to 72 hours with flavulgovane A at non-toxic concentrations, but we haven't run them out. We also haven't looked in animals. What are the other effects? Although others have. Others have looked in animals at comparable levels. I'm not really seeing overt toxicity in mice. I'm still not sure, though. So other effects, CYP1A1 goes down. I'm not sure that's necessarily a great thing. And it goes down. That's the most significantly downregulated gene among the effects. Specificity. If we're going to use the flavulgovanes as potential nutraceuticals, say, what are they going to do to other organs? You really need in vivo studies to address that. And also, you have issues such as bioavailability, potential for metabolic transformations, because of the methoxy group and some other chemistry. Lots of potential future directions, but also lots of potential caveats to getting ahead of yourself on this. So as a wrap-up, these are my acknowledgments. Keanu Pinner was the high school student. Again, his father has a kava farm in Hilo. My research technicians and a variety of UH-Hilo students, both at the PharmD and undergraduate level. And then this is us. So we're the Daniel K. Inouye College of Pharmacy. We're in Hilo. We've been in existence for 10 years. We're working on our new building there. Hilo can be beautiful if it's sunny, but it also rains a lot. That's cloud cover, not snow. And then we have a number of different laboratories, as Dr. Chang pointed out, a PhD program and also a PharmD program that we're pretty proud of. So I'd like to take any questions with that. I think that's an excellent question. One of the, squalene epoxidase is one of the enzymes that it looks, or the genes, it looks like it goes down. Right now, we're at the level of gene expression, protein expression as well, but in terms of metabolomics, we haven't done any because it's kind of hot off the press. It's only like a couple weeks old. So we'd love to, as a future direction, go down the avenue of metabolomics. I know that there's more than just looking at cholesterol per se because of obviously the number of pathways involved and also the potential to affect not just cholesterol but things like farnesylation and other pathways related to that. Great question, but we're just now getting into it. Thanks. You know, that's an excellent point, too. It's the incidence of the hepatotoxicity, I should have pointed out, is less than 1 in a million doses, and it's probably significantly less than 1 in a million doses. First of all, it's idiosyncratic. We don't really know what's going on, and there's a good likelihood that it could be a contaminant, like a fungal contaminant. There is a possibility, too, that people are using aerial parts of the plant that really shouldn't be. If you're familiar with the kava, it's the lateral roots that are harvested, dried, and used for consumption. So it's a great point that the people harvesting the plant should also be very careful when they're preparing it. And also very, very careful during the preparation, too. There was a case of rat lungworm recently on our side of the island where a slug got into the bowl and got smashed up and consumed. So just a word of caution. It's not just fungi. Thank you. Oh, yeah, of course. Contamination with the aerial roots. Yeah, we actually, so part of Keanu's project was to look actually at, he was doing LCMS on different parts of the plant, looking at leaves, looking at aerial roots, looking at lateral roots and the central root, and the aerial roots had more of the flavocovains, but so did the lateral roots had them too. So, and the figure that I showed you, the, like about 0.5% of FKA, was ethanolic extracts of lateral roots. So, but in regards to toxicity, it's still hard to say what the mechanisms are. The leaves, yeah, I wouldn't consume the leaves. I don't know. I just don't know much about them. So, I've heard don't do it, but I don't know why. Thanks.